Welcome to Good Next, a podcast about doing good in the world. Together, we'll dig into the experiences of people who do good in very different ways to understand what inspires them, what frustrates them, and what keeps them going. I'm Annalisa Enrile, a social worker, professor, and human rights activist. Whether you're doing good yourself or just thinking about it, I'm glad you're here. Last time, we heard from our Goodniks about how their weaknesses, personality quirks, and neuroses fuel their work. And we learned whether the kid versions of our Goodniks would be surprised with the paths that they've taken. Spoiler alert, not really. Doing good tends to start early. In this episode, we explore the moments that inspired our Goodniks, the moments they can't forget, the moments that are woven into their work, the moments that keep them going when times get tough.
That little voice in my head that said I wasn't smart enough, I wasn't good enough, I couldn't do this, it was constant. And I have learned to ignore it, and it's gotten softer. It's still there sometimes. But that voice was pretty loud in nursing school. And the first test I took in pathophysiology, being the perfectionist that I am, I promptly went outside the building, sat up against a wall, and started crying. Because I was convinced that voice in my head that said I'm not good enough, I'm not smart enough, was right.
Jennifer is a neonatal ICU nurse where she spends her days caring for critically ill babies.
Nursing school is nothing but nerves and competition. And so everybody's pacing and I'm sitting on the floor, I'm sitting on the ground outside the building crying. And the professor, Dr. Jack Pennington, he comes out and he sees me crying and he looks at me and he motions for me to come with him. And this was one of those just, amazing professors, unapproachable. And he motions for me to come with him. And I stopped crying because I'm in so much shock. And he walked with me. And we walked across the street. And, you know, he's a doctor and he's got his white coat on. And he pulls a pipe out of his pocket. And he starts smoking a pipe and walking with me through this parking garage. And it's a deep cherry tobacco and I can still smell it. And he basically asked me why I was doing this, which is one of the first assignments he ever gave us, was to write why we wanted to be a nurse. And maybe that's why he picked me to walk with him. But he started walking with me and he talked me off a ledge. And I, to this day, will never understand what he saw in me or why he picked me. But he became my mentor and he carried me through nursing school. And it was so full of so many ups and downs and dramas. I didn't see it until I got into it. But when I actually decided to embrace this change and this calling, when I actually got to the bedside, I started to recognize that nursing compassion fatigue presents as anger. I see people who, that is all that they see. They stopped remembering the beauty of healing. They stopped remembering the gift of medicine. I didn't recognize the problem until I got into it. And now I recognize the strength of my experience and I try to utilize it to combat that. I only know that if I go in and give it my everything and perform at my best, that maybe that little piece can help impact the change. Once I started to understand what nursing was as a calling to healing, I didn't understand the complexity and the enormity and how big that word could be. It became very clear to me at the beginning of COVID that there was something missing from this world, a selflessness, a calling to help each other. It's sort of like my patient stopped being a premature baby. My patient stopped being an individual person and my patient became sort of my community and this country. And I guess in a lot of ways, it continues to be that. And I try to go in and recognize that change begins with me every time I go in. I try to be the voice of positivity, even against all odds sometimes. And I don't wear a cape. I don't see myself as a hero. And I go in and I remember that it's about healing every time I walk in there, because it's easy to forget right now.
Interestingly, Jennifer was the only person we talked to who described her career as a calling. but I suspect that all the rest feel the same based on how they talk about their inspirations for doing good in the world. Sam is a police officer in a small town in New York State. He is the son of a world-famous jazz musician who died of cancer when Sam was just a teenager.
There are two main things that were taught to me. One was to give back and to be a good person, and one was to work hard. And those two things I've been able to bring together doing what I do. And because my parents were both the hardest workers that I know, my dad was the hardest worker that I know. He traveled 8 months, 9 months out of the year and not seeing his family, you know, to provide for his family. Music is so much more than just making music and being a famous guy. And to him, the Grammys meant nothing, for example. And the awards that he got meant nothing. I now know this because I follow his Facebook page and I talk to people that tell stories about him, is that he was so much more than his music in people's lives, in his fans' lives, in the world's lives, because he was such an amazing person and he would do everything that he could to give back to the people that loved him just for his music. He would give all of his fans his personal email, not to just make them happy. His personal email, they would email him, and then his fans tell stories about them exchanging emails until he couldn't any longer. And then it became so much more about than just the music. It was more about he was helping these people, helping them, his fans, people that he didn't know that he met twice, once, but helping them in any way that he could, whether it's producing or this or whatever. And I think that he taught me that, and I didn't realize that. And now I'm realizing that is what I need to do in life.
David founded a nonprofit that organizes against genocides around the world.
I spent every summer in the Catskills with my grandparents, no parents around for most of the summer, and I had the freedom to really do whatever I wanted. And my grandparents loved that. They stuffed my mouth full of food and I, you know, exploded. But I also had friends and we would just roam in the forest and explore and, you know, embrace what it meant to feel to be alive. But it was also there that I heard my grandparents' stories of surviving the Holocaust for some of the first times. We'll go on long walks at sunsets and overlooking the mountains with my grandpa and just having the sense that there was something important that I needed to listen to when they spoke and shared their stories. And then when I was 13 and 14, my grandpa brought me to the Mauthausen concentration camp where he survived for the very first time. So as a child, and that was right after my bar mitzvah, which is a Jewish coming of age celebration. And so we go from the party where I'm dancing and think that I'm hot stuff. And then I'm in the gates of a concentration camp for the very first time. And I get to understand what my grandparent perspective is on the idea of never again, on intergenerational responsibility to perpetuate memory. And I remember holding a video camera, one of those old school video cameras, not an iPhone because they didn't exist. And I was witnessing the former slaves on one end, the liberated inmates of the camp, including my grandpa on one side, and the American soldiers from the 11th Armored Division from Patton's army. And they were reenacting the liberation at the doors of the concentration camp, and those doors open. And there I am looking through this viewfinder recording. And it was one of these moments where I realized I became self-aware of like history, the moment, and feeling empathy for the first time. And I just grew up and I didn't know what the significance of that moment was, but I knew it was very important and it was way beyond me. And it informs what I do today.
Yossi uses art and culture to organize people in politics for social change.
For me, it was Robbie Canal in LA. At the time, I was 15, 14. I was spending a lot of time ditching school and writing on walls as a graffiti kid and a hip hop head and a fledgling raver. Don't tell anyone. I remember the first time that I saw a Robbie Canal poster out on the streets and it had a message. It wasn't just damage for the sake of fame or vandalism for the sake of vandalism or art for the sake of art. It had purpose. It had meaning. And people were gathering together to do something together to achieve a goal. There was a sentiment that was they were trying to relay and inject in a way that hit me like a ton of bricks. I mean, remember the poster. It was an gag me with a coat hanger. It was a poster of fighting abortion bans on the Supreme Court at the time and fighting for Roe. And it was like jaw-dropping to me. And it was revolutionary. And I immediately went down one of those rabbit holes and who is this and what are they doing? And it spread me into a universe of people who were using their craft and using their voice to try to affect the world around them in a way that was just like, I needed it.
Jesse is an expert in building movements, organizing thousands or sometimes millions of people to make change.
Barack Obama decided to run for president and bank on the idea that young people would vote. I'm not personally taking credit for it, but okay, I digress. This is about mentors. On that campaign, I met a set of individuals that forever changed my life. A woman named Margie Ault. Margie gave me probably some of the most important advice anybody has ever given me in movement building and organizing. Margie pulled me aside. I think I was 23 years old. And said, Jesse, you're really smart, but you got to get over yourself. And if you don't get over yourself and you're not willing to admit what you don't know, then you're not going to actually become a truly great organizer and movement builder. Now, in the moment, it's like I wanted to break down hysterically crying. I was so embarrassed. I think about that advice every single day. How do I get over myself? How do I have the humility to acknowledge what I don't know? I think ego in general is like a really fascinating topic, and it's something I spend a huge amount of time thinking about. Because on one hand, especially as a woman in leadership, you have to have a certain amount of ego to believe that you can make things happen. And at the end of the day, there is a real difference of doing this work for ego or for glory or for admiration and being in this work because you actually want to make impact and you actually want to make change. Like, I am in this work to win.
We've learned some important lessons from our Goodnicks journey about the power of inspiration. I was struck by how inspiration rarely comes from where we think it will. There's a good chance it won't be like it is in movies, a rousing speech with a soaring soundtrack, just when the character needs it the most. It turns out, it's most often something you weren't expecting or even looking for. It could even be something you didn't want to hear or happen in a place you didn't want to be. Did you know that there's an inspiration scale that measures how often we experience inspiration in our daily lives? And the reason people score high on the scale isn't because they encounter more inspiration than anybody else, but because they're more open to being inspired. So keep your heart and mind open, because you never know when inspiration will strike. In our next episode, we find out what happens when our Goodnicks come up against the limits of what's possible in their work. How do they make peace with something they can't fix? Thank you for being part of Goodnicks. Goodnicks was created and executive produced by Jeff Leitner, produced by Amanda Roscoe Mayo, with original music by Adam Ohlendorf. And I am your host, Annalisa Enrile. Goodnicks is supported by the Jim Joseph Foundation and inspired by every one of you who is doing good in the world. To learn more about Goodnicks, visit goodnicks.org. That's GOODNIKS. .org, or follow us on Twitter at The Goodnicks and Instagram at the_Goodnicks.